Hey idiots, I'm Jessica Michelle Singleton. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm also an idiot sometimes. Aren't we all? If you love to laugh as much as you love to learn about new people, I have a podcast for you called Hey Idiots. It's 50% hilarity, 50% curiosity, and 100% insanity. My guests include experts in their field, sometimes just other stand-up comedian friends, and occasionally absolutely insane people who have somehow convinced me they're knowledgeable about a topic. If you're into expanding your mind or just laughing out loud, check out the Hey Idiots podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello.
Hello.
And hi, welcome. There.
I'm Bridget.
I'm Brooke.
I'm Ian.
And this is Edging.
It's a podcast where Brooke and I don't know which one should introduce themselves first.
We certainly do not.
Nope, not at all.
A talk podcast filled with people who are bad at talking.
Yeah, we really are. We were just having like really intellectually stimulating conversations before we turned on these microphones and immediately.
I think we're all subject to the electromagnetic waves emulating. That's not the right word.
Emanating.
Thank you. From the microphones. It just fries our brains.
Yeah.
And we're like, we're suddenly not friends anymore once the microphones are on.
No. It's like the opposite of most entertainment.
Yeah, we just look up and we're like, shit, who are these people? There's a microphone.
I can't remember how I got here.
Let's talk.
Also, just have a weird thing of like, I feel the urge to like roast you whenever the microphones turn on with anything
cool.
that you say.
It's cool.
So like when you didn't get that word right and Brooke corrected you, I was like, somebody didn't go to college. Well, you still know a lot of words.
I went to college for a year and a half. Yeah.
That's plenty, honestly.
Yeah.
It's all
that's
pretty
all
much
need.
Downhill from there.
Yeah. This is edging.
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 We talk about books.
So the premise of it, if you're just hopping in, which kind of weird because this isn't the first episode, but if you're just hopping in, we are three friends. We have a production company together. Brooke really likes romance novels, and Ian and I are really into horror books.
But like different kinds of horror books.
Very different.
Horror is an interesting genre because it fits into every other genre also fits into it. And I feel like we're on pretty different sides of it.
Yeah.
Which makes it like not two on one. It's really more like 1-1-1.
1-1-1.
Yeah. I would definitely argue that romance and horror are both primary genres.
Yeah.
In that way. Mm-hmm. Like they fit into and other genres fit into them.
Yeah.
A lot.
Okay.
There's very wide spectrums,
That's
I think.
That's a great phrase. Primary genres. I like that.
Well, we're also talking
just
about
learning
it.
New words all day long over here.
Somebody's going
pretty
to college.
Sure I made that up, but
the people who went to college are teaching me a lot right now.
Brooke has talked about in the past when teaching us about romance novels, like words like bodice rippers, like that being a subsection of romance novels, which I just imagine that's like what Fabio would be on the cover of, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a classic bodice ripper. There are classic covers. I mean, we can get into so many different aspects of romance, but bodice rippers is what a lot of people think about. It's not really even at all what the genre is today.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of really popular for a while. Romance evolves as femininity evolves. Like, what does it mean to be romantic? What is the female gaze? What do people want? What like makes people excited? And that's a fascinating thing to bring up with the book that I'm going to talk about today, because we're going to talk about the book and then I'm going to ask you guys if you think it's romance or not.
Okay.
Okay.
So
that's a very interesting take. You mentioning though that romance evolves as femininity evolves, honestly, like that's something so good if we needed to cut it out for a trailer. Good buzzwords, Brooke.
Of course, that's what
I'm here
for.
If we needed to put it on TikTok. But
just need to repeat that like 10 times in the show notes so that all the search results come back to this episode.
Yeah.
But it is such an interesting thing to bring us into something that we wanted to talk about today with the female gaze evolving as well. Glenn Powell is an actor, as we all know.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He was most recently in the movie Twisters.
Yeah.
He was in Anyone But You. He was in the show Scream Queens, bringing it back over to horror.
He was in Scream Queens?
He was the Chad guy. He was
That's
the frat bro.
That's what I know him
from. I'm
going
to have to go back and look at that. I'm looking at it right now.
Emma Roberts' character.
Yes. Emma Rogers.
That's I almost called her Emma Watson. But, yeah, so he's been in that. He is very good about playing.
Okay, I've got it now.
Yeah, the himbo characters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you saw him in that before all of this.
I feel
like it's the bridge of his nose. Guys with a nose like that, I feel like usually play like a Chad type.
Yeah.
But have like this sort of wholesome vibe.
That's the thing. Like when Glenn Powell first came out, I had like people in my life, or not came out, because he's been acting for a while. But like when Glenn Powell blew up recently, I had a lot of people being like, oh my God, he's so hot. And to me, it just doesn't really connect with me. But the thing that is making me find him hot, I'm one of those people that like, even with actors, the personality that they show the world attributes, like it adds into whether I'm going to find them attractive or not.
You still have to prove yourself to me as a famous person.
Him leaning into, he knows what he is.
Yeah.
And I do, that does make me find him a little bit more attractive.
It's just, I mean, like it's honest and it's more fun that way
too,
you know?
Yeah. It's like Ryan Gosling, I never found attractive until the Barbie movie.
Mm. Yeah.
And that and the press he did for the Barbie movie where he was like, talking about his two young daughters, and one of them had taken a Ken doll and shoved it face first into the mud and left it out in the rain. And he's like, I need to tell this man's story.
Mm.
And honestly, and him singing Matchbox 20's Push to Barbie on the beach.
So much fun.
Like, no, I get it now. I didn't get it during the notebook when he's trying to kill himself on the Ferris wheel to get her attention.
I
got it in Barbie. I'm like, Eva, I get it, babe.
For me, it was, Crazy Stupid Love.
Mm.
See, I didn't even get it in that yet, too.
I got it.
It was Barbie, all Barbie for me.
It was
me.
Crazy Stupid Love for me, too, actually.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously, he could literally never replace Steve Carell in my heart. I would do anything for Steve Carell. But I was, like, starting to get it in Crazy Stupid Love. Because at first, I was like, I don't get this at all. But by the end of the movie, he'd won me over.
Crazy Stupid Love with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling made me actually want to see La La Land with Emma Stone.
That's bold.
And Ryan Gosling.
I still don't want to see La La Land.
I saw it, and it was fine. The movie itself was just so flawed that everyone who gave a really good performance in it, it just kind of drags it all down, you know?
Yeah.
So
there's definitely some movies with like good actors and stuff that just can't be saved. But one of the things that Ian had found that he wanted to show to us is about Glenn Powell, Brooke.
The thing that I appreciate the most about Glenn Powell is this new thing I've been seeing all over TikTok and like online. And it's that he looks like a capybara. And I would have never thought that myself, but the second I heard it, before I even saw it, I was like, holy shit, he looks like a capybara.
He does.
So I'm going to,
As you bring this to us.
Yes.
It's serving Animorphs. And I'm wondering at which stage in the transformation he is. Because I feel like he's not fully human and he's not totally capybara, but we're maybe one in.
At this point in the video, you're going to have to like put in an
image
of him like side by side with the capybara.
I think Mason could make it as where he's becoming one.
His anamorphing.
Oh,
I think that'd
that would
be
really
great. Nice.
That would be great.
Yeah. One of the things with Glenn Powell that I've noticed, because somebody showed a photo of him taking a selfie with his family. He's very close to his family. I've learned a lot more about him because of this stuff. Lives in Texas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They all look like they're in a Colgate commercial.
He's a little older too, isn't he? Like he didn't really... Like, he's been working for a while, but he didn't break out until, he's, like, 35 or something.
Yeah. The old motherfucker.
Honestly, the best way to fucking do it. Like, make a living, get by, don't be famous in your 20s.
No.
That fucking destroys you.
Yeah.
He's, like, already a person. His frontal lobe is developed.
Frontal lobe's developed, and now he's just, like, now that he's made it, he's, like, I moved back to Texas. He's going to college.
Okay.
He's getting his degree.
Yeah.
He said, I wanted to just make the money and go back home and live my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know what?
Yeah.
Respect. But he also, Glenn Powell looks to me like, y'all know how like AI is really about to take all of our jobs and shit. So he looks to me like if you typed into AI, like make me an attractive white male in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
it would be what AI comes up with.
Yeah.
Like a little bit Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
It's a robot. It's he a computer is slightly
uncanny. He does have a little uncanniness to
I
him.
I think that
he?
That happens a lot from Texas. I feel like there's something that's just a little bit too Grand Theft Auto, a little bit too game engine. Something's off.
Brooke and I spent 4 days in Texas recently, so we know.
Yeah.
About
we
Texas.
Know Texas.
Yeah. And then I like drove through Texas
yeah.
a couple
oh, yeah,
more
you
times.
All, you and Mason drove through Texas probably when you went out to California, didn't you?
Yeah. And it's weird out there. I literally got out of the car once to go to an Airbnb. We were in Amarillo, Texas, offense meant if you live there. And we got back in the car and left to go stay somewhere else. It was actually like an empty Grand Theft Auto game level. And everyone's like, oh, you're being whatever. There were stray dogs.
Yeah.
There were a pack of dogs ran across the sort of deserted street. And our Airbnb was cute, but like the code wouldn't work to let us in. And we were both just like, I feel like this is a sign.
Yeah.
I feel strongly. We had to stop at a gas station and everyone was like an NPC, just kind of standing around, not talking. And I was like, I will not be interacting. This is a real vibe.
I feel that because whenever I go through some areas, I get that vibe. But then I also remember that my hometown is that for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, your hometown really is that for
because
other people.
Like you talked about like stray dogs, like dogs will pack up where I'm from, like stray mm-hmm. dogs will all get together and make a pack mm-hmm. and unfortunately like have killed people and other animals. Yeah. But I was driving home one night. I was working at the news station, so I got off work at like 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. And I drove the 3 hours to my hometown. I had a key to my dad's house, so I would get in at like 1-2 o'clock in the morning, me and my dog, because it was just easier than trying to go to bed and then wake up and mm-hmm. drive. And I come around this blind corner, and there is a pack of wild dogs sitting in the road, and I had to move around them like Frogger. They didn't move for me.
Yeah.
I was slowly having to just drive around them because yeah. they wouldn't move, and they were all looking at me.
Yeah.
They were all dogs, but they were all looking at me like, what?
Well, yeah, you're not at the top of the food chain in that moment.
But they're also looking at me like, we're not going to fucking move for you.
Yeah.
You get around us.
Yeah.
And I'm just slowly driving. Like, it felt like, these dogs, I was like, are they going to like open the door? Like, I don't know. But that's like when people drive through my hometown, they get that same vibe.
I think that's kind of true about everybody's hometown.
Yeah.
Unless you're one of those people that's like from a big city, of which there are like four. And we all know that. I feel like when you go to your hometown with someone else, you'll just like say something and the other person will be like, what? And you'll be like, oh, well, it's, you know, just
you
like
all,
the regular thing.
You all live
thing.
In my hometown now, yeah, and that happens
true.
To us all the time.
Yeah.
Or like with my hometown, I brought somebody who, because I'm from the mountains, I'm an Appalachian girl through and through, and I brought somebody from closer to where Brooke's from in Kentucky, like a more flat Kentucky, to Eastern Kentucky one time, my old roommate Allie, and she said things that I'd never picked up on before mm-hmm. as being weird. Like, she's like, I don't see a lot of apartment buildings here, but I see apartments above gas stations. Is it just easier to like do that? And I'm like, yeah, because we don't have a tunnel. Like, the terrain's rough, so you just kind mm-hmm. of
you can't build a 3-story building in a lot of places over there.
Well,
like down where the established town is,
yeah.
they've already done it.
Yeah,
everything
so it's
left,
just you're
you
gonna
do yeah
live above a like I, we lived above our apartment when I was a kid. I think was above a mechanic.
I think that's something that really you have in common with the Northeast, like where my husband Mason's from, because I really encountered that visiting him. He always talks about how big the sky is out here. You know, he's like, it's so big because he lives in a valley. Like, mm-hmm. that's where he grew up. And I think my parents are from Southern California. I grew up in flat Western Kentucky. Like, I'm not used to seeing mountains where I am. I'm not used to, like, being in them. And I think that's true with the land out there, too. Like, it's weird when you're from, as we know, I think of Kentucky as both the gateway to the Midwest and like it's sort of the gateway to the Appalachian Mountains. You know, you like go through central Kentucky
and to the south. We're just the gateway
yeah.
drug of states.
We're just the gateway. Yeah, we are the gateway drug of all of it. But I'm from the part that is in Illinois.
Yeah.
and Indiana. And like it's so flat. And the idea that you don't have enough space is incomprehensible.
I think
everything is parking lots.
I'm the only one of us that's from like true Kentucky, I think, probably.
Yeah. Right?
Well, you're also this town that you're from where we're recording right now.
Yeah, where
there's
I don't
a
live
sign
anymore.
Literally underneath us because we're in an apartment above a restaurant. There's a sign beneath us that says Gateway to the Mountains.
Yeah.
So this is considered the kind of last stop before going into Appalachia.
Yeah, which I wouldn't really consider it that.
I wouldn't consider
it
that.
I would say like a couple towns east is more accurate.
Well, no, but I consider this the gateway to the foothills.
I would say that this is the gateway out of the mountains.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
I can see that.
Because I consider foothills and mountains different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, like the going into a town and seeing like an, like in my home region, I'm just picturing in my head one of the abandoned buses that's taken over by the kudzu plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those kudzu like growths out there are so cool.
Yeah.
I know that they're a nightmare ecologically, but they're so cool.
They're beautiful. I've seen houses taken over by them.
Oh yeah.
And whole like mountains, like every pole is just covered in kudzu. It's absolutely beautiful, like Glen Powell. But a little bit uncanny, a little bit unsettling.
Did some soldier come back from like the Pacific in World War II with the kudzu vine and just like plant it?
So it was
innocently, or what
the,
happened?
One of the first ladies, the one who tried to do the beautification thing.
Oh, Mary Bird Johnson.
Yes. So
Lady Bird Johnson. What the fuck?
I have no idea what you're
Mary
saying.
Mary Bird.
Wait a minute. We've talked about her husband's dick on this show.
We have, in fact. Yep.
Yeah.
I believe it was his hog.
His hog. Yeah, My bad. But Lady Bird was going to like beautify the country, and a big part of that was they were like, "Oh, well, we need something here," so they brought this kudzu plant, not realizing how invasive it was.
They planted all the famous cherry trees all over Washington D.C. They did all these cool things, and they just threw some fucking vines into Appalachia
and said, "Here you go."
It's literally biological warfare. Yeah. I swear, this country has been waging war.
I have
50
kudzu.
Years later, the biggest budget some of these towns have is fucking kudzu, like. Extraction or
demolition,
whatever.
Yeah. I have kudzu tattooed on me because I do miss my hometown. I do think it's beautiful to look at. My dad is like, he worked as an electrician, and he's like, "God, that stuff, trying to fucking pull it up and move around to get to these towers."
Because it's tough. Like, it's a...
Oh, yeah. It's not just a little vine.
It's not like a potato vine coming up out of the ground.
It's fighting you.
Yeah.
It's still so pretty.
It is.
Very pretty.
Like Glen Powell.
But yeah, he definitely looks Uncanny Valley to me.
Yeah.
Even in Scream Queens, I thought that. He's got a very triangular mouth, but he owns it. I do appreciate the fact that he knows who he is, and that's the sexiest thing you can do as a person.
100%.
Is know who you are.
Well, today, I think we're going to be talking about a character who doesn't know who they are.
Ooh.
Really at all. So I want to get into this a little bit, and I want to start by talking about the book cover, and I want to read you all the summary on the book.
Okay.
So we'll just start with the book cover. The book we're talking about today is by Gail Honeyman, and it's called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine. I wanted to show the book cover, so it's in there. We'll get into, there's a little bit of controversy around this book. Just a little bit, nothing too spicy. But I want to read you the summary, and then we'll get into it. Eleanor Oliphant struggles with appropriate social skills, tends to say exactly what she's thinking, and carefully avoids unnecessary human contact. But everything changes when Eleanor meets Raymond, the bumbling and deeply unhygienic IT guy from her office. When she and Raymond save Sammy, an elderly gentleman who's fallen, the three rescue one another from the lives of isolation that they had been living. Ultimately, it is Raymond's big heart that will help Eleanor find the way to repair her own profoundly damaged one. If she does, she'll learn that she's capable of finding friendship, and even love, after all.
Okay.
Except for the unhygienic part, this is essentially like us with our husbands.
It's like any love story.
Yeah.
The unhygienic part is me.
Yeah, I'm the unhygienic part. But yes, Brooke and I are both married to IT men.
Mm-hmm.
But no, so I do find this interesting. It reminds me of there's this movie, I haven't watched it, with Nick Offerman. And there's like two people there as well. And it seems like it's kind of a similar vibe of like it's a friendship is building amongst the three of them. But there's also like a relationship going on. That's the vibe I got from hearing somebody talk about the trailer. I didn't watch the trailer. It's an older movie, but.
Yeah, I love just assuming that I know what a movie is about from the trailer. I love trailers. That's really about as long as I want anything to be. Yeah, I think that's kind of the vibe. So based on the summary on the book and the cover, would you read it?
I probably would if I like had a lot of free time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
With being a dad, it really limits what I have time for. But
yeah, you have to be pickier.
Yeah, back before I had kids. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I don't have kids, but I feel like this would be something that I would be grateful to have read if it were assigned to me in a class, mm-hmm. like an English class. I don't think I'd go out on my own and look for it. I'm trying to think of what our scale will be and what I would rate the cover of.
For a second, I forgot what the scale was.
Yeah, so our scale, we make up a scale. It's completely arbitrary every time to rate the cover. Right now, I'm rating the cover. How many teeth are there in the human mouth?
I don't know.
32?
Like a regular 32, one?
Okay, so I'm going to say Glenn Powell has 35 because he's got a very toothy smile.
Yeah, he does.
I'm going to give it 4 out of 35 Glenn Powell teeth.
Okay.
Specifically his teeth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Ian?
I only have a few of his teeth, so, you know, from what I can tell, 4 out of 35. Wow. Okay. I would go with, like, 20 out of 35.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also really cherish my collection of Glenn Powell's teeth, but having read this book and having a little bit of background knowledge, 35 out of 35 teeth.
So you got all his teeth. Up there. Taking our teeth.
Yeah. He's got extra teeth in this.
They grow back.
We know that he grows teeth. Like, what is it? A skin cell? Like you've got brand new skin every 7 days or so.
He just sheds teeth.
Yeah, like he's just always losing teeth. You follow the guy around long enough, you're going to have a full mouth of teeth.
They're always so beautiful and pearly.
Because you don't have any time to damage them.
He
doesn't
fuck them up with cigarettes and sweets like we do.
They just fall out every 7 days. There's no time to do any damage to those things.
Absolutely.
Which is why once he eventually dies and there's no more Glenn Powell teeth, the actual number, the finite number of Glenn Powell teeth will be set and they'll become a lot more expensive because there won't be new ones coming onto the market all the time.
A non-renewable resource.
So, mm-hmm. Listeners, if you have any of Glenn Powell's teeth, don't sell them now. Wait until he's gone and then start selling them. The market's going to go up a little bit on it.
Might be insider trading, but...
Well... Who cares? Who cares that much?
He's a man with a podcast. He can do insider trading, Brooke.
That's so true.
The rules don't apply to me.
That is so true.
There are no laws that govern men with podcasts.
Alrighty. Well, I think that this is a good time to... Hopefully we have a toothpaste commercial or something coming up here.
I was thinking...
a good lawyer.
You heard it here, Colgate.
Yeah.
And we'll see you guys after the ad break.
Alrighty then.
Well, that was a beautiful ad. Made me laugh, made me cry.
Yeah, we're back from that, honestly, masterpiece of advertising.
Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, whenever I start to get just like a little bit nervous, I sometimes have the habit of just throwing myself into credit card debt with buying stuff that I don't need at that moment and I probably don't need at all. And I feel like I'm going to do that with the product advertised in that last ad.
You know, and our listeners should do that with those products.
The little bit of dopamine you get by buying something you don't need, but you do need this.
You know, I've actually seen scientific studies that you don't need to eat if you've got that dopamine rush going 14, 15 hours a day.
Unless it was a meal kit ad, in which case eating is so important.
It's really important.
And you should really make sure that you're investing in that.
Yeah, and you probably ought to buy two subscriptions for each person, really, just because...
Hungy.
Exactly.
I think I've replaced smoking cigarettes with buying little things.
Yeah.
Like I'll be like, I need a claw clip right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a lot more healthy than, you know, my replacement, which was ketamine. so just on a lot of ketamine all the time.
Every time you do ketamine, a horse has to do a surgery completely awake. I saw a meme that said that and I was like,
yeah, hell is real, and its horse is doing surgery.
Do we think
ketamine.
That a horse killed
the
Matthew
horse
Perry?
Is doing the surgery?
That's the real thing. Is the horse a horse has to operate on another horse? Nobody has ketamine.
Nobody has ketamine. A little bit. Usually, when a horse does a surgery, he does a little bit of ketamine before.
You skim a little off the top. It's only fair.
So
a horse, of course.
So do most human surgeons.
Yeah,
you know, which is why surgeries go so well.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of ketamine keeps your hands from shaking.
It sure does. Mm-hmm. That's a great little side.
Brooke, you read a book.
I did.
We do read, even though we sound dumb as fuck.
Yeah, and you too. If you're dumb, you probably are if you're listening to the show, you can read too.
Just another real quick aside. We were looking at these lava lamps, and they look like little pigs in there. I don't know. Can you see that on the screen?
No.
Oh, okay. That's a shame.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, there's little pigs in there. The wax is like solidified into a little pig shape.
It is a little pig shape.
A little pig.
Well, I think that's a great jumping off point. You know, pigs are cute.
It was real important that we showed the listeners that.
This is interesting. And another thing that's interesting is this book. So I started off by telling y'all how this book sells itself. And now I really want to try to sell it to you.
Okay.
I want to tell you what I liked about it. Because I'll go ahead and tell you that the scandal around this book, I found it in the library Libby app as a recommended based on like what I've read and by searching for romance fiction. And I listened to this book in like 3 days. I could not stop. And it profoundly changed me. And then at the end, I was like, what are other people saying about it? And one of the top things was people being like, all right, I just feel like it's really weird that this was marketed as a romance.
Mm. So that's the scandal, whether or not it's a romance?
And people are like really pressed about it because I think for so many people, romance is escapism. What makes a romance book a romance is that it follows a formula and you know it's going to have a happy ending.
Yeah, it's the rom-com.
You read it. There's drama and there's pressure, but it follows this certain formula that you feel like you understand and you feel like you know. And if you're looking for that and you pick up this book, I can definitely see why you might be surprised. I was pleasantly surprised, and I will be arguing that this book is a romance.
Okay. All
right. So
are we arguing? Or you're convincing us.
Yeah, you can feel however you like. This is not debate team. You don't have to take the
offensive. I've decided it's not a romance.
Okay.
Ian's going to be the devil's advocate. How
wow.
interesting for the man in the room.
Wow.
So I'm going to start by just reading one of my favorite quotes from this book. And then I'm going to kind of walk through it with you, as that is what we do on this show every time. This book is in first person. So I suppose one of the reasons we're all able to continue to exist for our allotted span in this green and blue veil of tears is that there is always, however remote it might seem, the possibility of change.
Had some audio issues with this episode, unfortunately. What you're about to hear is everything that Brooke actually said in the podcast. It's just her re-recording it. Thanks for hanging in there with us. Now back to the show.
So it's in first person, and she's describing these things that are happening in her life. And it's not a thriller, but it sort of feels like you're untangling a mystery because she's an unreliable narrator. I mean, we all are. We love an unreliable narrator. It's so exciting to encounter situations and then like have things remind you that you can't just believe everything she says. She's just describing the world as she sees it. So the book is in three parts: good days, bad days, and better days. And most of the book takes part in good days. And the sections sort of get smaller as it goes on. But my synopsis of the book would be a little different than what they say on the back. I would tell it like this. Eleanor lives alone in an apartment that she shares only with a parrot plant named Polly. She works in an office as a finance clerk, and she's been at the same job for nearly a decade. She's almost 30. We learn that her life has been pretty much the same for the last 8 years. She goes to work during the week, buys the same lunch specials, does the newspaper crosswords, goes home, and makes pasta pesto every night. She talks to her estranged mother on Wednesday nights, and Fridays after work, she buys the same pizza, a bottle of Chianti, and two large bottles of vodka. Then she drinks from Friday evening until Sunday night to ensure that she is neither drunk nor sober as she waits for Monday. And she tells us that Monday takes a long time to come. Her only regular visitor is a social worker once or twice a year, and she receives some government assistance. She doesn't remember the event that sent her into foster care when she was 10, but the right half of her face is covered by thick burn scars, and her mother is incarcerated in some kind of facility. We know all of that pretty early on, and that's where the back of the book leaves us as well. Whenever something reminds her of the event that sent her into foster care, she avoids it. Like, mentally, she avoids it. We see her avoiding it. She is unwilling or unable to let those memories in. But everything is about to change because Eleanor has fallen in love.
She was at a concert with a coworker, Billy.
And we hear about this experience because she is standing in the break room and no one has noticed her.
He is making fun of her to the rest of her coworkers and talking about this weird night that he went on with Eleanor, the weird girl at the office. And she like literally doesn't care. She's like laughing at some of the jokes they're telling about her. She doesn't care what they think about her at all. And it's like clear to us that Billy thought this was a date, and like Eleanor would never think that. Like, she did not ask him on a date. She was like, I won these tickets to a concert at a work raffle. I don't want to go by myself. And if I don't go, everyone at work is going to ask me about it. So I have to go. And she asked him because he was the youngest person and she thought he might like it. But while she was there, a band went on and she saw the musician, Johnny Lohman. And she has decided that he is the man for her. So she just stands up and leaves the concert, and she leaves her coworker there and like literally doesn't even think to talk to him again. So she says that fate had unfurled her future, and she tells us that she's determined to learn everything she can about this musician whose name is Johnny Lohman.
Can I just interject and say that this is how I've heard most women describe how they flirt? By like seeing someone that they're really attracted to and just fucking leaving.
Yep.
Well, in this situation, she leaves her coworker. But
right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she was like, oh no, I have to go think about this. That is very relatable, I feel like. That's the female experience.
Yeah.
And it is also the next part is the female experience where she's like, well, I'm in love, so now I have to buy a computer. How else will I learn everything about him while I am at home?
Mm.
Okay, so she meets Raymond, who is the IT manager at her job because her work computer stops working. And
Raymond is the like, what do we call him?
Well, she the describes poorly, him. She compares him to
hygiene.
A pig.
Yeah.
So she's really suspicious of new people and people in general. She doesn't like other people, relatable again. And every time she meets a new person, she usually is super judgmental of their looks. And now she sort of starts comparing everyone to this musician that she hasn't met, but she saw on stage. Mm. And that's like, obviously that's her candidate for future husband. That's what she's going for. And that's her prerogative through most of the book. But she meets Raymond. She compares him to a pig. She thinks it's disgusting that he smokes, and she thinks that he's a slob. And as far as we can tell, Raymond seems to like her. He thinks she's fine. He's like very normal to her. And so the next time we encounter Raymond, they just like happen to leave work at the same time. And he's like, oh, are you walking this way? And like, what did you do this weekend? And in her head, she's like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen to me. And she's like desperately trying to ditch him. And as they're walking, they see this older man, Sammy, collapse at an intersection. Raymond is like, oh, Eleanor, we have to go help him. And she's like, I don't know why. Seems like he's just drunk during the day, sort of a him problem. And Raymond is obviously like, Eleanor, come and help me help this old man. And so she does. And he like shoves his phone at her because he wants her to call 999. The story is in Scotland. And she can't. She immediately has a panic attack, sort of internally. It doesn't turn into a full blown one, but we just hear her describe memories of sirens. And she tells Raymond that she's going to sit with Sammy instead. And like he goes and calls an ambulance. The rest of the story sort of just progresses from there in the good days section. Eleanor continues to visit Sammy in the hospital. And, you know, Raymond kind of encourages her to do that. He's like, come on, you know, he's going to want to know us and like meet us when he's conscious. She is really surprised once Sammy wakes up to find that, like, she immediately likes him. And she doesn't like anybody. He's just, like, nice and paternal and keeps saying that, like, they saved his life. And you can really tell that Eleanor is caught off guard anytime anybody is nice to her. Like, she really doesn't know what to do with people being nice to her in a way that is in any way inconvenient to them. Her entire world is, like, being polite or being convenient. And like whether or not things are rude or like equally exchangeable. Sometime throughout this process, she goes out for a drink with Raymond and she is about to walk away after they have a beer. And she like asks him for the like whatever $3 his beer was, because it would never occur to her to buy a drink for another person. Mm. And so like we see her learning these things because Raymond's like, oh, OK, I guess. And she like always comments on how much he tips service people because she's like, oh, extravagant. Somebody doesn't care about his money. And we're really watching as she just sort of is analyzing every situation she's in. But she and Raymond kind of get folded into Sammy's family. And he's like in his probably like 60s or it was between 60 and 80. I don't know how old he is. And his family is like super grateful to both of them. And even after Sammy leaves the hospital, they're inviting Raymond and Eleanor to like a coming home party and to like birthday parties. And Eleanor is treating all of these things as like practice for when eventually, of course, she's dating the musician Johnny Lohman, and he'll expect her to be able to like be social. So she starts trying to become like this version of herself that is romantic. We know that she's not ever been interested in dating anybody before. And she is like really insistent that like she doesn't need anybody. She's fine on her own, but she is, everything has sort of changed. And now that she's in love, she wants to like take more care in the clothes she buys. She wants to be more fashionable. And the whole process that she goes through as she tries to be ready for love is pretty amazing. She like decides she needs to get a bikini wax and a manicure. And she learns how to do her makeup at the counter of a department store. And she buys nicer clothes. And all of these things, obviously, varying degrees of success. I would highly recommend reading the book to see how she encounters each of them. But she's really surprised that everyone in her life, like all of her coworkers, seem to just be much more like positive and respond better to her just because she like started wearing different clothes and put a little bit of makeup on. And I want to read you guys a quote from the book to kind of describe this. Because I think my favorite part about this story is how funny she is. I like was laughing out loud.
So far, this is sounding a lot like a romance.
Right?
I think.
I mean, devil's advocate. You heard it here first, folks. Right? This is Eleanor describing her coworkers just like being nice to her. Was this how it worked then? Successful social integration? Was it really that simple? Wear some lipstick, go to the hairdressers, and alternate the clothes you wear? Because prior to this, she was wearing like the same outfit every day. Someone ought to write a book, or at least an explanatory pamphlet, and pass this information on. And she finds, as she like is sort of overwhelmed by other people's response to this, at first, like, her impression of Raymond is really negative, but he's just like a very chill person and like clearly is like, we should like have lunch and hang out, and they're just becoming friends. And she's like, I think like sort of trying to figure out his angle most of the time, but then it just sort of happens that she realizes that they're having lunch together once a week at work. And when he says to meet him at their usual spot, she's just like, I have a usual spot. She's so excited to have like a place that she goes with a person. And she's not using words like friend. She has literally no one in her life at all. So this is sort of like all very brand new to her. And for Raymond's part, you know, we only get to know what he's thinking through her observations of him, which are unreliable at best. He seems to just like her and like be happy to hang out and isn't like hitting on her or like not in a romantic way, like genuinely just friendship. And he is also like completely shook that anybody cares that she's wearing makeup or changing her clothes. He's like, really? That's pretty weird. And so they're like just both commiserating over that. And throughout the book, Eleanor ends up getting an offer for a promotion that she takes. And she's been at this job for 8 years, but she is genuinely surprised that her boss like finds any value in her. And kind of interwoven through this is the complicated relationship with her mother. So the only human interaction that she regularly has other than going to work is every Wednesday night she talks on the phone with her mother. And in these calls, which Eleanor always dreads, her mother is never nice to her and is never listening to her. She calls her ugly and stupid. She talks over her. Like, she like is actually never listening to anything. She's only talking. She tells Eleanor that she has no friends. And then, which is true, but just mean. But this is all of this is sort of in response to Eleanor kind of reluctantly talking about meeting Sammy and Raymond. And her mom is like, no, you don't have any friends. You're mistaken. These people don't actually like you. So really kind of undercutting these new experiences that Eleanor is having. Her mom is obviously very abusive. And we know like has very like limited phone time, like is in some kind of facility. Her mom is not like free to go and do whatever she wants.
So her mom is like getting something out of this.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Like just and it kind of like comes to a head because we understand that there's some sort of event that had happened in Eleanor's childhood. And we know that she was in foster care from the time that she was 10 up until, you know, she aged out of the system and that she still gets some kind of assistance with her apartment. And all of her furniture also, Polly the plant is the only thing that she has from her childhood. That's the only possession. She has literally nothing else, like no memorabilia, no photos. And she is like requested, we learn when she meets with her social worker, she's requested to not be told anything about it. And that's like completely up to her. So they can't tell her anything. Throughout the course of the book, she turns 30. And so like that's where she is in her life. She's 30. She doesn't want to remember anything about this event before. And her main fixation is this musician. And up until this point, it has just been living. And she talks a lot about being lonely. She talks about how it's sort of like ridiculous that she hasn't just died from loneliness before now.
Has she still been like kind of looking up and like checking out the musician this whole time?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
She gets a computer and she is like following him on all of his social media accounts. And we can tell from everything about him that this guy's a total chode.
Yeah.
He's like completely uninteresting. 100% regular. And she's describing, like, everyone she's comparing to this, like, he's a fashionable man. He's the right kind of guy. And she doesn't really know anything about him. And she knows that her mom will like that she's pursuing this musician. This would be something her mom would approve of. And she starts to, as people are nice to her, that really affects the way she feels about her mom. And she starts to, like, kind of retroactively think about things from her childhood. She meets Raymond's mom and, like, comments on how nice she is and, like, how sweet she is and how weird it is to imagine growing up in a house like this. And on one of the calls, so she misses a call for the first time ever. She has not seen her mom since she was 10. They only talk on the phone. And she has never missed one of these Wednesday night calls. And she misses one to go and see Sammy with Raymond pretty early on in the book. And after that, we see her mother, like, very aggressively punish her on the next call. And on the next call, her mom threatens her, telling her to turn the other cheek for mommy. And we know that the right side of her face is totally scarred.
Oh.
So we're sort of untangling exactly what's going on. You know, the whole book, something is wrong. Uh-huh. You know that her mother is abusive. All of that is coming out, but it just, like, keeps developing. And Eleanor does not want to tell you. That's part of what I find really engaging about this book. She is desperately trying to avoid it. So you kind of have to encounter it through all of the subtext. So we're pretty deep into the story at this point, more than halfway through the book. And at this point, Eleanor, I think, considers Raymond a friend. They're having lunch every week. She's, like, started dressing differently and buying things she likes. And she's pursuing the musician. At one point, she stalks him to his house and, like, stands outside of his apartment door and then luckily goes home. And she's sort of working up the nerve, like, to be ready to meet him. And she's, like, trying to prepare herself for that. She says she doesn't really have a bad, impression of her appearance. Her mom is constantly calling her ugly and vile and stupid. But she doesn't seem to be really bothered by the burn on her face. She's like, well, that's just something I can't control. That's not related to anything. And she describes herself, like, aggressively as average. She's like, being average is good. Nobody can notice you if you're average. You blend into the shadows. But she kind of describes herself as needing to be presentable to be with someone who's famous. You know, that's important for, and he's not really famous, but maybe going to be famous. And there's one point early on where she talks about looking in a mirror. She's like, I need to address this. I need to look in a mirror, which she doesn't do often. And I need to really face what we're working with. And she sort of describes her appearance. And then she tells us that she's not afraid of looking in the mirror because of the way she looks. She knows she looks fine, but she's afraid because she'll see the, like, genetic resemblance to her mother staring back at her. And all of that's just sprinkled in. We don't go deeper. Eleanor only cares about the musician. She's, like, incredibly dismissive of everybody else and does start to invest in Raymond. Like, she starts understanding buying drinks for other people and, like, they have a real companionship and, like, genuinely get along. And then there's sort of this situation where she and Raymond are at one of their lunches. And this really hit me as I was reviewing this book because I feel like it says so much about the way the story develops overall. But they're at one of their lunches, and while Raymond's in the bathroom, a baby starts crying at another table. And this is one of the most explicit clues of, like, how the book is going to develop. But a baby starts crying and Eleanor starts actively panicking. And it's a very, like, intense passage to read because, like, it's very overwhelming because you're like, I don't know what she's going to do. I don't know how this is going to happen. And this baby is screaming and Eleanor is, like, having a panic attack and just staring. And part of this is that she starts flashing back to someone else crying in her past. And we don't know who it is. And with her, like, begging this person to stop crying. And then when the baby's mom picks the baby up and starts kissing him, Eleanor is so overwhelmed. And she just tells us that her heart soared for him. Oh. And that's sort of how that section ends. And it's really, I think ultimately this book is so obviously about love.
Still sounded pretty much like a romance to me.
Yeah.
The part that really struck me was when she was standing outside the musician's door, because someone else stands outside of all of our digital doors. And in doing so, they learn as much as they can about us. And then they deliver us the most beautiful, heartwarming advertisements that are just perfectly suited for each of us.
And we love them for that. That's love.
That is love.
Let's give you some love. That was a great ad.
I myself am flooded with gratitude.
Yeah.
And warmth. I'm comfortably warm.
Yeah. I feel my heart is bigger for having heard it.
Which is a medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
We should really check on that. Every time she hears ads. Palpitations.
My heart grows. My heart just starts beating. So Eleanor is also growing. Her heart is growing. We really see her learning in baby steps how to accept love and what love could look like. But she's definitely held back by something, and we don't know what. Most of the novel takes place through the course of like about a month. So it's a few weeks, you know, they meet Sammy and really see the love his family has for him and that he has for his family. And then soon after this lunch date that Raymond and Eleanor are on, where the baby cries, Raymond asks for her to come out to lunch again. And she's like, twice in a week. Calm down. That's a lot of time to spend together. Like, I was comfortable with once. But she goes, and she noticed that Raymond doesn't seem to be doing super well. He seems to be like kind of out of sorts, kind of jittery. And she's also like really growing into her own, like at their regular restaurant. She talks to like the waiter who she knows by name, and she knows what's going on with him. And we see her really interacting with people also ambiently socially in like a stronger way. And that's something that Raymond's really good at. He's very social. He's very good at talking to like strangers and getting to know them. So Raymond shows up and he tells Eleanor that he has to talk to her about something, and you know, it's going to be really hard. And Sammy has died of a heart attack. So basically 3 or so weeks after his initial hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And
Sammy.
I know. And they sort of have this moment where they grieve through it. And we've learned that a few years ago, Raymond lost his father, and Eleanor's encountering a lot of like just really normal grief. You know, these are all older people, and she's encountering, when we first meet her, she's really crass, and it's really hard for her to understand like empathy in any of these situations. But at this point, she feels herself also being really overwhelmed with sadness. And when she's sort of like, Raymond has like a little bit of a fling going on with Sammy's older daughter. And like Eleanor has noticed it and like doesn't feel weird about it. Like there's nothing romantic between her and Raymond, but she's just like noticed it. And we see it sort of through her eyes. So like we don't really know what's going on, but it seems like just a vague fling. And so he like knows more information. But her father passed away at her house. He had a heart attack. And Eleanor's immediate response is sort of like, well, do you think the police are going to suspect foul play? And Raymond is like, Jesus Christ. He's like, Eleanor. And she's like, oh, no, is that not what you're supposed to say? And it's really not sure if that's why, but that sort of triggers her own emotional experience. So she starts crying and Raymond comforts her and he puts his arm around her, and she does not like to be touched. Throughout the book, we like know she doesn't like to be touched. Sometimes she wears gloves when she's in public because she has really bad eczema. And we notice that she also has like a little bit, like definitely some kind of OCD tendencies. She's very worried about cleanliness. I think that's sort of why we get the description often of Raymond as unsanitary.
Mm.
She's very concerned with things being neat and clean and like being in control of them. But she finds that when he puts his arm around her, it is comforting. And she'd never really understood that before. But she tells us that it's like really nice being comforted by another person. So she and Raymond grieve and decide, you know, Eleanor's like, obviously we should go to the funeral. And Raymond is like, you know, yes. And so they do. And it's pretty typical funeral stuff, kind of messy and really human. And it's clearly the only time Eleanor's really experienced this. She's never been part of healthy grief in any way. And she gets really drunk at the funeral, and Raymond brings her to his place, and then they end up just watching a movie. And this has never happened. Like, they're not so close of friends that she would come over to his house. The first thing she says when she walks in is like, basically like, I thought it would be filthy. And he's like, we're not animals, Eleanor. He lives with like three other men. And he's like, yeah, one of my roommates is pretty neat, and we're all like adults. And so yeah. she's like immediately
surprised.
Does he
just like not shave every day? And that's why she thinks he's disgusting.
He wears like sneakers and t-shirts and smokes cigarettes. And she's okay. like, he's a pig. Like, she's like, good. And that's part of how unreliable she is. And one thing that's really delightful about reading through her perspective is that, like, she's not unwilling to be wrong. Like, she's just like, oh, okay. She's just learning. She's never been to anybody else's house, really, other than when she was a kid or when she was living in other people's houses through foster care. She never got placed permanently.
Yeah.
She describes, in reports, she's described as a sort of difficult child who had to be moved a lot. And that sort of comes up later, but for now,
like, getting drunk at a funeral too, that's like, that's just being from Kentucky.
That's just being a person.
I feel like that's like a bigger deal in other places. We're just all sitting here like, well, yeah, of course you got drunk at the funeral.
And I think it's normal in Scotland. I think everyone is really regular about it.
Oh, that's right. I forgot this is in Scotland.
Yeah. So like, they got it.
The original Kentucky.
That's yeah. right, actually.
Kentucky,
yeah.
Kentucky Prime.
Scotland is the Kentucky of the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So Raymond takes her back to his place, and they just kind of like relax and watch a movie. And she's sobered up by this point. I think she fell asleep at the funeral. He like there was the bartender was pretty predatory, and he was clearly over pouring her drinks. Mm. And she's not encountered anything like that before. So Raymond is obviously like, we're leaving, like, fuck you, to the bartender. And she falls asleep like in an alcove after he makes her eat a bunch of sausage rolls. Sausage rolls are a theme. It comes up a few times. She also, every time she goes to an event,
really is the Kentucky of the United Kingdom.
We
yeah.
have pepperoni rolls.
Pepperoni rolls.
You.
Yeah.
Eleanor, we have sausage balls. They're so good.
They are good.
Eleanor is sort of like everything in every moment. She's constantly so funny and relatable. She has to buy a purse because she doesn't own one. She only has a shopper, which is like a little bag on wheels that she takes everywhere. And up until she started like reinventing herself, she only wore like Velcro shoes and like work clothes that were the same. And she just had several pairs of them. And like everything was very much on a routine. And then she's like, well, I guess I can't go to a funeral with my shopper. That might be kind of inappropriate. So she brings this like little bag, and she talks about both how impractical it is and how much she loves it, which is so the female experience. And she like laments that she'll only be able to fit a few sausage rolls in it from this event, because everywhere she goes, she just like fills her bag with the free food because she's an icon.
Yeah.
I love it.
She's on a budget. Like she knows, she's like, I can only afford this apartment because of the government assistance. I got to be careful. Got to like budget myself. So she and Raymond end up having this like great night. She's like totally sobered up after her sausage rolls and nap at the funeral. And they just like watch a movie together. And she notices that like Raymond seems to be struggling because he's drinking like way more than her. And like she has a little glass of wine, and they're just vibing. And she's like so surprised by how fun it is. One of the moments that she really brings up is that at some point he brings out a bag of chips, and she's like, the bag says like for sharing. And she's like, I've never bought that one before, because she's never shared food with people. And she also talks about how like part of the reason she eats lunch out went at the office, even before with Raymond, she would like go get a value meal once like every day. But it was because like when she bought food for herself, it would always go bad before she could eat it.
Yeah.
She just like, she's just so isolated in her own world. But she has a great night with Raymond, and he calls her a taxi home, and they're just fully friends. And we see her like realizing that, but also not knowing exactly what that means to be friends with someone, and she's figuring it out. So this is sort of, we've been building in small ways up to this point. We know that the musician, who clearly is like an idiot, and we see like his tweets and all of these things that she's stalking him online.
Oh, that's fun.
He's leaving his band to go solo, and they're playing one last concert.
Never a good idea.
Never a good idea.
It never works.
But she buys a ticket, and she's prepared. This is it. She's going to meet him. And she knows, obviously, because they're soulmates, that he'll know her and see her from the stage. And that's sort of where we leave off. You know, like, it's about to be the concert. And then you flip, and it's the next section of the book, which is The Bad Days. So we sort of encounter the concert after the fallout. And her descriptions of it are really muddy because she's really confused. Pretty much, she stays like pretty much as drunk as she's ever been for the next few days. We learn eventually through kind of vignettes as she's like trying to like make it around her apartment. And I mean, she's down very bad. She's not eating. She's only drinking. And at one point she leaves to buy more alcohol at the corner shop she normally goes to. And like, we can tell that the purveyor does not want to sell it to her. Because I think she picks up like two or three handles of vodka and he's like, three? Really? And she's like, just basically non-responsive. She's only been throwing up. She hasn't talked in days. And she takes it home. And we learn that she goes to the concert and pretty much immediately she realizes that she doesn't even know this person. That he's not going to see her in the crowd. And she just, as soon as she gets out of this bubble of fantasy, she knows exactly. She's like, he was never someone that I loved, and he was never going to love me, and this was never going to fix everything. And it's sort of this break of her narrative up to this point, because she's for the first time admitting that her life has been broken. And that understandably sends her into a spiral. He's like a total ass, but it's so immediately not about him because it never was. Mm-hmm. And everything he does that's like embarrassing or stupid is just like more heavy for her. She ends up getting really drunk at the concert. And then at some point they turn on a smoke machine and she runs out of the bar and throws up outside.
Yeah.
And it's been, you know, hinted at pretty heavily that what happened was a fire when she was a kid. And that it's burn scars across half of her face. And there's more explicit hints to that throughout.
That's interesting. I'm just putting together, too, that the cover cuts off at her neck and you don't see her face. Yeah.
And it's really interesting it being from her perspective, too, because you learn really early on about her burns, but you sort of forget about them because she doesn't talk about them.
I've forgotten about them several times.
She doesn't talk about her appearance, and you recontextualize her interactions as you remember her burns and how people might respond to seeing that on her face. She describes it as a disfigurement. Like, she knows that it's like noticeable and that people can see it, but it's just, she early on when she's having feelings for the musician and she's like, well, luckily, even though he's a very attractive person, and I feel bad for very attractive people, she tells us, because people are always looking at them and beauty is fleeting, and they would have to deal with that. But she's like, I think that it'll be great because he and I will be able to relate because we're both used to being stared at all the time. Mm. And she's pretty blasé about it. Yeah. But this realization that she was putting all of her investment in the future into this guy hits her immediately. She immediately realizes that he's literally just a stranger. He's not interesting. She doesn't know anything about him and she doesn't care about him and that this has never been about him. This sends her into a spiral. And we learn pretty much in the first few pages of the book that she gets painkillers from the doctor just to stockpile them in case she wants to kill herself. And it's like pretty, I don't know that she says that. We just know she's stockpiling them. And we know she's heavily drinking when she's not at work. But she doesn't drink in public often. And so like she ends up getting drunk at this concert and then leaving. And then she doesn't remember how she gets home. She gets home and she is just drinking and spiraling and trying not to remember what happened. And we don't know exactly how long this is. She doesn't know how long it is. She just knows that she's like getting sick and drinking more and not eating. And her plan is to drink herself to death. I think that she thinks about the stockpile of pills, but is pretty content to just, she's not been sober through any of this. So she's like pretty content to just keep drinking until she dies. And then at one point she hears someone shouting and banging on the door. It's probably been days. And she like, all she remembers in the moment, she tells us she opens the door and throws up, and then she wakes up. Obviously it was Raymond. He's cleaned her entire apartment. And like, she hears the washing machine running. She's grateful to see a glass of vodka on the table, and then she drinks it and is disgusted that it's water. And I can't remember if he's there or not right when she wakes up, but he's obviously taking care of her. So she and Raymond talk, and she's obviously very blasé because she's like, he's like, what was going on? And she's like, well, obviously, Raymond, I was trying to kill myself. She's still so funny. We start getting glimpses of things. She's still talking to her mother every Wednesday. And the therapist, at first, she's really scared to talk about her mother. And we learned that, like, as a kid, her mom told them to never trust social workers, to never, like, her mom was very, like, aggressive about keeping, her mom pulled her out of school at one point.
Yeah, she was isolating her.
Yeah, really isolating. And Eleanor talks about physical abuse. The only relationship she had ever had was a romantic relationship with someone who was just, like, a classic abuser. And she's just, like, pretty blasé about it because she doesn't let people in. You know, to her, she says this, she's like, pain is easy. Like, pain is so easy. I can do that, but it's the loneliness. And eventually, Raymond brings her a stray cat that one of his roommates rescued from being burned alive in a trash can. And when he tells Eleanor this, she goes and throws up, obviously. He has no idea really what happened with her. I think he at some point did some Googling or something, but she doesn't even know. So he tells her about this cat, and he's like, I didn't know if this cat would be good for you, but I thought you might like her. And I have to read the description of the cat. And then we can go into the end of the book.
Okay.
So the cat on page 442. Here we go. So he brings in this like box and all of this litter and like kind of starter cat stuff. And he's like, obviously with everything that's happened, I'm not sure if you're ready for like a pet, but I thought you might like her. And this is how Eleanor describes the cat, who has like a bunch of bald patches because she also has been through a traumatic event. And she says, the cat squirmed in my arms and landed on the carpet with a heavy thump. She strolled over to the litter tray, squatted down, and urinated loudly, maintaining extremely assertive eye contact with me throughout. After the deluge, she
which is the only way I pee when you guys are around.
I mean, it's the only way to pee. After the deluge, she lazily kicked over the traces with her back legs. Also how we pee with each other in the room. Just kick over the traces with our back legs.
Well, for the listeners, we've all got our own personal litter boxes underneath the desk here.
I mean, we're not animals. We don't all use one.
Right. We're not just pissing on the floor.
But, you know, she kicks the litter around with her back feet all over the freshly cleaned floor that Eleanor has just cleaned. And then Eleanor says, a woman who knows her own mind and scorned the conventions of polite society. We were going to get along just fine.
That's so cute.
So throughout this section, Eleanor is going to therapy. You have put together, like, as the reader by this point, kind of what's happening, but you're just waiting for Eleanor to get there. And if you're listening on the main feed, we're going to bleep this next part. The full episode is available on Patreon. I would highly recommend this book. We're going to come back and talk about whether or not it's romance after the bleep. So we can settle that. But yeah, for our patrons, here we go.
Also the name of Glenn Powell.
Scotland's different than here. That's sort of one of the big surprises or turning points of the book. But the real contentious point here is whether or not this book is a romance. Yeah. And was it incorrectly billed as one? And in order, before I tell you why I think it is conclusively a romance, I'm going to tell you guys the Romance Writers of America, which is a nonprofit trade association for authors of romance. I really like their definition of romance. They have a lot of different ways they describe it, but we've talked a lot about how romance novels have the same sort of structure. And I think that this describes it well. Two basic elements comprise every romance novel: a central love story and an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending. I don't think I've ever read a book with a happier ending.
Yeah.
Or like a more optimistic outlook. And I would argue that every good romance novel shows us a main character who's learning to love themselves.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, it's not a good love story if your character doesn't love themselves. Because it's pretty impossible to love someone else. I think that this book ends with Raymond asking her on a date. That's up to interpretation because they've gone on several sort of outings together. But there's really no other point in this book in which it would feel okay at all for him to ask her out on a date. It would just be like weird and like predatory and bizarre. And they have been friends. But it really feels like a book where we are watching like all of the hard work that leads to that moment that someone feels like worthy of love and capable of loving.
Yeah.
And that is where we leave Eleanor. So my conclusion is that like, it's possible the marketing of this book is misleading, but I feel like I can't fault any piece of art that I consume for being difficult to categorize. I feel like that's what makes it so good. And like I said, I think this book is about love. I think it's about being a messy person and like how you're never in the right place for love and how it's never really like you think it's going to be. And I read a lot of romance, and I think the ones that stick with me are the ones that change my perception of the world and that I feel like highlight the complexities of love and partnership. So if you're looking for a sexy, erotic, exciting, sweep you off your feet type of romance, I wouldn't go for this one.
Yeah.
But if you are in a place to read a book like this, and this book can be hard to read, the depths of the loneliness are really overwhelming. I will say this isn't the only romantic novel that's made me feel this way. I read another book recently that I will talk about as well, but it's new, so we'll have to wait like 2 years. I had to put down a lot because in order, like, love is hard and those hard things come up. But I think it's really hard to write good, complex characters who are connecting with one another and like avoid loneliness or self-loathing.
Yeah.
Or their baggage. So I think you should, I think honestly, if you want a book that will literally make you laugh out loud and leave you feeling hopeful about the world, you should read Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman.
So starting out, I voted this 4 out of 36 of Glenn Powell's teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe 35, I forget.
I think he has 35 mm-hmm. teeth at any given time.
Yeah. Now I got a whole Glenn Powell set of teeth.
Wow.
Like I would want to read this book. I would want it to be a movie.
Mm-hmm. It is going to be. I think Reese Witherspoon's producing it. And I think...
Of course she is. She's always out there. This is a compliment. Reese, you're out there doing it.
We're Team Reese in this house. I think, I think it's going to be a movie soon.
I love that.
Well, you'd read it?
I would. I'd probably cry a lot. I mean, there's a lot of things that you were discussing that, like, I mean, obviously I did not go through that type of abuse and, like, sibling loss and stuff, but, like, the things that happen to you in life kind of leading to a lonely section. I wasn't that isolated, mm-hmm. but it's tough to be alone for a long time.
Yeah.
And dealing with all of that. And I think that, you know, her learning to be okay with herself mm-hmm. and to be fine is a lot more of a love story than like The Notebook.
Yeah.
I would fall in love with Ryan Gosling if he were in this movie.
Yes.
I would not fall in love with The Notebook's Ryan Gosling.
No.
I also agree that The Notebook is trash.
I would.
Is that what we're talking about?
That. Yeah.
No, I think, a full 35 out of 35, a full mouth.
Full mouth.
Just a full mouth.
Full Glenn Powell mouth. Yeah.
Full Glenn Powell mouth.
The full denture.
Full denture.
Yeah.
The full necklace of Glenn Powell teeth.
Well, you heard it here, folks. That's one full mouth, and that's one full mouth for Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine.
I think that's the highest rating we've ever given a book.
I think it is.
I think so, too. Yeah.
And listeners, if you have any of Glenn Powell's teeth,
hold on to them.
Hold on to them. Send them to
unless,
us.
Yeah, unless send you want to send them. If you want to,
we're still trying to get this podcast off the ground. We can use that income.
If you want to pay for your Patreon subscription with Glenn Powell's teeth, we can just email us.
I don't think that we can do that through the Patreon system, but yeah, let us know. We'll figure it out. We'll get an arrangement together.
Leave them under a park bench in a little baggie, and that's how we'll pick up Glenn Powell's teeth.
And Bridget actually knows when you do that. Yeah. You don't have to tell her where you're going to be. Like, she just knows.
I feel it.
Yeah. I love that the Bridget lore keeps growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel it in the teeth that they are?
Not in my teeth because I have really bad gingivitis.
Mm.
So mine, it's more of a like, left rib kind of feeling. Yeah. That's where I feel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel, that makes sense, I think.
The original teeth. Yeah. But yeah, and Glenn Powell, if you want to give us money.
Or teeth.
Glenn Powell wants to come on the show and talk about a book. You know, we'd love to, we'd love to have him.
That'd be great.
Shake your hands.
Come on, Glenn.
And the cat. Is that the cat?
Mm-hmm.
Glenn.
The cat, Glenn.
Yeah.
Bring all a cat, Glenns. Glenn. Or that little dog you got. That's cute, too.
Yeah.
Anyways.
If you don't, you're a coward.
Yeah.
All right.
Love y'all.
Bye.